Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the ADA and Alternative Dispute Resolution Mediation Conference Call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions on how to participate will be given at that time. If anyone requires operator assistance during the call, please press star, then zero on your touchtone telephone. And as a reminder, today's conference call is being recorded. Now, I would like to turn the conference over to your host, Robin Jones.
Thank you, and good morning and good afternoon to everyone, depending on where you might be connecting with us from today. I want to welcome you to this session, and thank you very much for joining us in August. I do know that this is a very busy time for people with vacations, wrapping up the summer, and things of that nature. So thank you for taking time out of your day to join us. I think we have a great session today. I just wanted to alert people that we had a change of plans in that the representation from the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, there was an administrative change there, and they had chosen or not to participate in today's session specifically. So we do apologize that we are not going to be able to represent the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission's mediation program today in our presentation. So again, I apologize for that. Let me just go through some of the housekeeping things for today's session. One is to remind people that this session is being recorded, and it will be made available later at a later time as a recording for you to listen to. This session is also being real-time captioned, and there were instructions in all of your materials as to how to access the real-time captioning. And we also have individuals joining us today through streaming audio and on the telephone. All of you have options for being able to submit questions to our presenters, and we strongly encourage as we go through today and you hear the presenters speak and discuss their different areas that they are representing or have knowledge about, just jot down your questions and be ready to ask those when you get a cue from the operator that we're ready to take questions. We do strongly encourage you to do that. You should have received some materials that the speakers made available for us today, an outline of their presentation and such, so hopefully you have access to those as well. Again, that information was in your instructions for accessing today's session. So I'm going to go ahead and get started at this time, and I'm going to introduce our speakers and then turn over the microphone to them. First, we have with us Lisa Levine, who's the ADA Mediation Program Officer, a long title, big name, with the Disability Rights Section of the Civil Rights Division in the U.S. Department of Justice. She's been with the position for the last 5.5 years. If you're not familiar, and you're going to get more familiar with that program today as we go on, the ADA mediation program is intended to resolve ADA complaints in an efficient and voluntary manner. The program has proven effective in resolving complaints at less cost and in less time than traditional investigations or litigation. Prior to taking her position with the Department of Justice, she was the Senior Equal Opportunity Specialist at HUD, which is the Housing and Urban Development Federal Office of Fair Housing and Equal Employment. There, she trained investigators nationwide on the Uniform Federal Accessibility Standards, conducted compliance reviews of large housing project authorities, and participated in negotiations of voluntary compliance agreements in the area of housing. She's also worked as an investigator at the Disability Rights Section and at the Office of Special Counsel for immigration-related unfair employment practices, and she's a trained mediator and previously directed a nonprofit organization assisting immigrant farm workers in Homestead, Florida. We are also joined by Louis Dabney, who is the director of the Key Bridge Foundation. He's a nationally recognized leader in the field of ADA mediation, having helped manage the Americans with Disabilities Act mediation program for the Department of Justice since 1999. He has a MSc in conflict analysis and resolution, and in addition to his work in ADA mediation, he's both focused on ethnic and religious conflict and served as a consultant on international alternative dispute resolution projects, providing technical assistance, including system design and program monitoring and evaluation. He has been involved in training hundreds of practitioners around the world in introductory and advanced mediation and negotiation techniques, and he's lectured at different universities, including those in the South and Southeast Asia, South America, North America, and Europe. He also served as leadership of the International Section of the Association of Conflict Resolution for several years, including as chair, and is currently in his second year serving as secretary of the board of that organization, which represents about 4,000 members. In addition to Lewis from Key Bridge Foundation, we are joined by Donzel Robinson, who has done extensive advocacy work for the last 12 years in the area of the ADA as a complainant liaison for the Civil Rights Division of the U.S. Department of Justice. He's currently a professional mediator certified by the Maryland Council of Dispute Resolution and recognized by the Association of Conflict Resolution, which is the national organization representing this industry as a practitioner and trainer. He specializes in workplace, domestic, civil, and healthcare mediation, as well as mediation training in those areas. His experiences include being appointed a mediator in the Circuit Court of Maryland to mediate issues of custody and visitation, and an arbitrator for the Better Business Bureau. He's provided consultation and training in the areas of disability rights, alternative dispute resolution programs, and issues related to developing cultural competence and sensitivity training. So I think that you can just tell by the bios of these three presenters today that we have a very highly qualified group to speak to you on this particular issue. This is an area that I know our office and this program being presented to you as part of the ADA National Network. I know that the centers nationally receive a lot of questions related to mediation and the use of mediation and alternatives to going into the courts on some of the ADA disputes that individuals may have. So I think you're going to learn something today about that program and about mediation in general. And to that end, I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to our presenters, and Lisa Levine will start us out today. Go ahead, Lisa.
Thank you, Robin, for that introduction, and thanks to the Great Lakes ADA Center and the ADA National Network for arranging this program. We know it takes a lot of time and effort, and we appreciate your bringing attention to this important topic of mediating ADA disputes. A woman called me in tears because she couldn't take her son to their local sub shop. She lives in a rural area, so there aren't that many choices, and this was her son's favorite place anyway. She uses a wheelchair, so the steps going into the restaurant impeded her from entering. She was so frustrated and just didn't know where to turn. So I explained that she had the right to file a complaint under the ADA with us at the Department of Justice and that she could be offered free mediation. I told her what that would look like, that we would assign a trained, third-party, neutral person, and if she and the restaurant representatives agreed to sit down together, the mediator would help move along or facilitate the discussion, but the mediator would not be a decision maker. I also explained that any agreement would emerge from her and the restaurant, and that any settlement would have to be in concert with the ADA, ensuring compliance. She was concerned about talking with the restaurant folks, who she said had refused to listen before, which is understandable. But I explained that she could bring whomever she wanted to the mediation and that DOJ would provide everyone with some technical assistance materials before they sat down together. She was also glad to hear that the mediator would be familiar with the ADA and experienced in handling disability discrimination complaints. I let her know she wouldn't lose any rights by agreeing to mediate, as the complaint would return to the Department of Justice from our mediation contractor if the respondent refused to mediate or if mediation failed. Fast forward a couple of months. The woman called me again in tears, but this time they really were tears of joy. She had filed the complaint with the Department of Justice, participated in mediation, and she had returned from lunch with her son at that very restaurant. The restaurant had built an entrance ramp, removed other barriers, and apologized to her. And that's really what the DOJ ADA mediation program is all about, informing people with disabilities of their rights and entities of their responsibilities, empowering all people to have a say in the outcome, and most importantly, enforcing the ADA, ensuring access in a participatory, voluntary, and efficient way. So I'd like to now just give you some background to our program, explain more about how it works, and share some of the successes and key elements to the program. And then I will turn it over to Lewis and Donzel of Key Bridge Foundation, our partner in this program, our mediation contractor. In 1994, the Department of Justice began a grant with the Key Bridge Foundation and created a nationwide mediation roster. Experienced mediators were trained on Titles 2 and 3 of the ADA. And those were volunteer mediators back then, showing their dedication. The goal really was to help the Department of Justice more quickly resolve ADA complaints. Even in the statute, it says, where it's appropriate, alternative dispute resolution techniques, including mediation, should be used. It was a real shift, a shift away from the traditional adversarial winner-take-all method of problem resolution and a movement towards the alternative methods of dispute resolution. And mediation hadn't really been applied to rights-based disputes, so it really was cutting edge. And it was also a way for the government to handle complaint resolution without direct intervention. The government enables the process to happen, but the Department of Justice is not a party to the mediation. And then in 1999, we started a contract with the Keybridge Foundation, so we actually pay mediators now. The Department of Justice pays for the program, which is free to the parties. We're always asked, what types of cases do we take? Well, you've heard we handle Titles 2 and 3, not Title 1. So just state and local governments and public accommodations, not employment, EEOC does handle those, and they too have a mediation program. We found that a variety of cases lend themselves to mediation, including barrier removal, frequently involving curb cuts or parking, steps, or inaccessible restrooms. Effective communication cases also lend themselves to mediation. In common complaints we see involve allegations about the refusal to provide sign language interpreters, for instance, in hospitals or medical offices. We also handle policy modification complaints. Many complaints we receive are from individuals contending they were refused service, for instance, at a store or a restaurant because they use a service animal. And we also handle the Title II program access cases. For instance, if court proceedings are held in inaccessible places. You know, some complaints are straightforward while others are much more complex. As we identify appropriate complaints for mediation, there are a series of questions we ask here at the Department of Justice. Namely, does DOJ have jurisdiction and is this a valid complaint? And what's the nature of the complaint? Importantly, we ask, are the possible remedies flexible? So do the potential remedies allow room for negotiation within the framework of the law? An example would be, we would typically not take new construction or significant alterations complaints as there's no wiggle room. We also look at whether we can identify the right people to get to the table, the decision makers. And I'll tell you one thing we don't ask. We don't ask how likely is it to have an agreement. We certainly like successes, but there are other intangible benefits from mediation, including increased communication between the parties and education. You know, maybe it's the first time for a store manager to sit down and talk with a person with a disability. Here are some of the keys to our program. It's voluntary. And this means, in part, if mediation isn't working for either party, he or she can withdraw. Additionally, it's confidential, so that nothing said or produced in mediation can be shared unless the parties agree otherwise. Parties really do control the process and the outcome, and this cooperative approach can preserve the relationship between the parties, and this is especially important in rural areas where people with disabilities, as you know, have few options for carrying out business, leisure, or government activities. A crucial point is that DOJ will not simultaneously investigate during the mediation process or investigate if a successful resolution results. So this may benefit all the parties. Any agreement must be in harmony with the ADA, and we're really mediating within the framework of the law. As you'll hear more from Keybridge, mediation occurs locally in communities where people with disabilities live, work, and play, so having trained mediators around the country is critical to our success. Of course, when it's needed, telephone mediations are arranged. What if, for instance, somebody travels from Texas to Florida for business or vacation and She filed a complaint against the hotel that had no accessible rooms. Also, for reasons of disability, we do phone mediation. We make absolutely certain that the mediation process is accessible to either party that has a disability. In short, it's quicker than an investigation, inefficient, much less costly than litigation as well. So what's the process? How do we make this happen? Well, a complaint is filed with the Department of Justice, and people can request mediation on the complaint form or letter they submit. That's not required, and it's also no guarantee that we'll accept the complaint for mediation, but it certainly helps to say you're open to the possibility of mediating. It's reviewed for jurisdiction, once again, only Titles 2 and 3, and we'll then contact the complainant offering mediation, explaining the process, providing technical assistance materials, and answering any questions. You know, we do caution complainants that the complaint may be closed if the complainant declines mediation without a good reason. A good reason for declining mediation might be that the complainant would be fearful of retaliation by the respondent. Then we at the Department of Justice wait for a signed release for referral to mediation by the complainant, and once we receive that, we then have the authority to contact the respondent offering mediation. We'll explain the process and provide technical assistance materials and answer any questions the respondent has, and that's when we refer the complaint to the Keybridge Foundation. If mediation fails, though, or the respondent refuses to mediate, Keybridge will return the complaint to the Department of Justice. I'll then send it to the Investigations Unit here in the Disability Rights section for them to review. There's no guarantee that the Investigations Unit will open up an investigation. I will say, however, that DOJ doesn't look favorably upon those entities unwilling to even give it a try. So the Investigations Unit will be inclined to open those. Parties lose nothing by participating. The complainants always have a right of private action. Your federal civil rights are preserved. You know, remember that if a complaint returns to us at the Department of Justice for possible investigation or litigation, DOJ really represents the interests of the government. DOJ doesn't represent either party, so neither party may be satisfied with the outcome. You determine the outcome in mediation. Some of our global outcomes include we've referred over 4,000 complaints for mediation under the contract, and we have a 78% success rate over the life of the contract. This is remarkable, particularly given how we define success. A unique facet of our program and one we pride ourselves on is that we don't count a case as successfully resolved until the implementation is complete and until the complainant confirms this, or in rare cases, until it's well on its way with benchmarks met. So basically, a case is not a success until the ramp's actually been built, the parking restriped, or the new policy implemented, and the training complete, or whatever else the parties have agreed to has been done. Once the complainant verifies that they're satisfied with the implementation, that's a successful case. Our mediation program provides an environment where people with disabilities can speak on their own behalf, make decisions, and resolve issues. But of course, people can bring advocates or attorneys if they desire. By not having the Department of Justice as a party to the mediation, this preserves the integrity of the process and maintains the separateness needed in case of a future investigation if mediation fails. Overall, businesses and state and local governments have eliminated architectural and communication barriers or changed discriminatory policies, allowing thousands of people with disabilities to participate more fully. For instance, in Arizona, a person who's blind and uses a service animal alleged that a hotel charged a nightly surcharge for the animal. The agreement called for the hotel to adopt a new policy and no longer charge extra, providing staff training, post signs, and refunding the complainant. In another case, a creative agreement that might not have happened in an investigation or litigation occurred when a person who uses a wheelchair complained that the checkout aisles of a Georgia grocery store were inaccessible and that store employees refused to help him. The grocery store made the checkout aisles accessible, and the complainant agreed to participate in quarterly staff meetings to provide disability sensitivity training to employees. So you see that both of these examples show that the person affected benefited from mediation, but what about some other interested parties who weren't present? People with disabilities who hadn't yet entered those places also benefited. Now, if this sounds like parties have to do some work in this process, that's true. Active participation is what makes it work and gives parties the freedom to figure out what matters to them within the law. It's good for the complainants, as they can be heard and enjoy the services or programs offered, but it's equally beneficial to the respondents, as being inclusive is better for business, and they might just want to avoid a Department of Justice investigation. Both of the parties have interests and responsibilities, and mediation helps people identify them. Before I close, I'd like to acknowledge that we recognize that people with disabilities or advocates may have seen mediation as, quite frankly, a cop-out for the Department of Justice. Some people tell me as they question whether they'll participate in mediation that DOJ should do its job. It's not my job, they say, to enforce the ADA. But we at DOJ see it this way. Not only does the statute say, when appropriate, use alternative dispute resolution methods, but if people have a say in the outcome, as long as the ADA is upheld with the agreement, doesn't that accomplish even more? It not only achieves access in the built environment and effective communication or policy modifications, but it really helps to dispel the stereotypes of people with disabilities and to increase communication among people who may have ongoing interaction. Empowerment may be an overused term, but mediation can indeed be powerful. So first, Lewis and then Donzel will expound on this overview and provide the practitioner's perspective and explain what happens after the Department of Justice refers the complaint to the Key Bridge Foundation. Lewis?
Thank you so much, Lisa. It really is such a pleasure to hear you provide that overall perspective on the work that we do together every day. And it's such a pleasure being here a part of the ADA National Network's distinguished audio conference series. The TIPTACs have consistently lined up such excellent speakers to illuminate the world of ADA practice, and being a part of that is really great. And seeing that overall perspective, when you work in a program every single day, it's easy to be absorbed in the details of it and to get together on the phone with your audience and reflect on the larger perspective. It helps me see what the broader view of what we do every day. And as Lisa said, there have been over 4,000 complaints referred to us since I joined the program in 1999. And I personally supervised about 1,500 of those. So that impact over time has really made a difference. I'm traveling around the country these days, I'll be in a small community somewhere and see a hotel and think, oh, I remember that case. Or where there may be a court system in a large city that was not previously accessible, to know that that's become accessible, these cases one at a time, these mediations one at a time, have really made an impact. And so Lisa did a particularly good job of showing how the individual is affected by this and also that cumulative impact. And basically, the ADA mediation program works with people with disabilities, disability advocates, businesses, state and local government, of course, the Department of Justice, Civil Rights Division, Disability Rights Section, ourselves at KeyBridge and our roster of mediators around the country, originally more than 500 practitioners were trained. Many are still active over these years, and these stakeholders all together have worked in this collaborative spirit that is alternative dispute resolution, where skilled, impartial third parties work with people with different positions and interests to come to an agreement resolving a dispute. And specifically here, these are complaints, obviously, about lack of access under the Americans with Disabilities Act. And it really has been such a pleasure and a privilege to see the cumulative impact of this program over time and to basically have promoted the voluntary compliance with the ADA at the level that we have. Obviously, an important distinction of what we do is that this is mediation and not investigation, and so that all of what we do is voluntary. Donzel and I will be spending the rest of our time going over the outline that has been distributed to all of you, going into more detail about mediation and the ADA mediation program process. And one additional element I'll touch base on before passing it on to Donzel is the experience of having worked on this program for more than a decade. Originally, as Lisa said, our mediators were volunteers. And in fact, the DIPTACs worked with the Disability Rights Section and the KeyBridge Foundation to train the original roster of ADA mediators. And for every mediation program functioning, there are different practices, and they vary widely. But oftentimes, a mediator's role is just in meeting with the parties and reaching an agreement or not reaching an agreement. And when the program was originally started in 1994, we just passed cases to mediators and they would contact the parties, have a mediation. When there was an agreement, return the matter to us. So it was very hands-off in terms of supervision and administration. And over time, we have developed an understanding that given the complexity of ADA complaints and given the importance of mediating in a civil rights context, that building in quality assurance techniques, building in a partnership between a group that is interfacing between the Department of Justice and the parties has been very important. And originally, we just referred cases to mediators and had very little involvement. Over time, the Department of Justice, disability advocates, business community, mediators, everyone recognized that having greater involvement from a supervisory and quality assurance perspective would be particularly helpful. So now, KeyBridge takes a very active role in reviewing all agreements to make sure that issues in the presenting complaint have been addressed and that there's nothing contrary to law that's been agreed to. We also keep cases open, as Lisa said, until the parties to the agreement confirm that the terms of the agreement have been implemented. In many mediation programs, there's a less clear way to ensure that agreements are actually implemented, and we see very actively involved in that. In addition, as conflict resolution professionals, when the release to participate in mediation is signed and the Department of Justice passes us the case, we contact the complainants and respondents and orient them towards the mediation process. So we have a very hands-on involvement with every case and have developed a range of best practices that we'll go into further as our presentation continues. But I'd like to pass this off to my colleague, Donzel, who will explain more about what mediation is.
Thank you, Lewis. So at this point, what I want to get into is just basically an overview of what mediation is. It's the foundation of the program. It's what allows the parties to come together to resolve their disputes. And what I want to do is start by giving some basic principles of mediation and then kind of segue right into how the mediation process works for those of you who are a little less familiar. I think the first thing that we should mention is that mediation is not therapy, nor is it a day in court. And what we mean by that is it's not our goal to try to hinder the parties in any way as far as what they believe they deserve, whether it's the complainant as far as what they believe they deserve as far with regards to their rights, or the respondent as far as what they believe they deserve and their ability to provide solutions. Our goal is to also to demonstrate that the mediators are not judges. We're not fact finders. We're not there to render a decision. Our role is to manage the process, to be experts in the process, and allow the parties to be the experts in the subject matter, in this case, the ADA or the Americans with Disabilities Act. We do not decide how the conflict will be resolved. The parties do this, and we facilitate that by assuring that the fairness of the mediation process, by facilitating communication, keeping the lines of communication open, and attempting to maintain a balance in participation. Many times you'll hear it called a balance of power, but we recognize that power is subjective. What is not subjective is whether or not all parties can participate. And you'll find that in every instance from whether you're mediating parents and children, employers and employees. You really can't focus on the balance of power. What you can focus on, though, is the balance in the communication and involvement in the process. We emphasize always that mediation is informal and that it's confidential, meaning that you're not bound by specific rules and guidelines. You're not required to enter evidence in a certain way. If a person wants to say, I can't get into an entrance of a building, you do have a ramp there, but the ramp isn't in compliance with the ADA. We don't take them through a bunch of hoops in order for them to prove that. We start with having the parties talk about it. Is the ramp in compliance with the ADA? How will we determine if the ramp is in compliance? Allowing the parties to be the experts, allowing the parties to decide how they will come to an agreement on the information that is there, and then continuing that as far as allowing the parties to be the experts on what the agreement will be. Of course, you know, keeping it, as Lisa said, in harmony with the ADA itself. We also facilitate this communication by emphasizing that the mediation proceedings are confidential. And this is important because it allows the parties to put everything on the table. It allows a respondent to be able to talk freely about what they can or what they believe they cannot do, whether it's expenses. It allows the complainant to say what they would be willing to accept if the respondent would be willing to do things. They may be willing to take a less severe tact on what they want. A perfect example would be if a respondent who says, you know, I just can't afford to do to change a bathroom today. A complainant may say, well, how about if we allow it to take 3 to 6 months? If the respondent agrees, the parties agree, we have a formal agreement. But in the event that the parties do not come to an agreement, the respondent can't say, oh, well, the complainant agreed to allow me to have 3 to 6 months to do something. So confidentiality allows the parties to brainstorm, to work together openly and honestly without the fear of anything that they say being used against them. Additionally, we remind the parties that it's voluntary. The Department of Justice did refer to mediation, as Lisa indicated. They may not look kindly on parties who do not participate or at least give the process a try, but when we define voluntary, what we mean is you have the right to come up with an agreement. You have the right to say that you're not satisfied. You have the right to say you're not going to sign an agreement that you do not fully and wholly agree with. We emphasize continuously that the process is between the parties. We also explained that parties have a right to have an advocate there or an attorney there. It is not required. The parties can come, you know, by themselves, speak for themselves, and we also ensure that they have the confidence of knowing that they will not be taken advantage of and that all agreements that we do through the program have to comply with the ADA. And most importantly, what we emphasize to them that a successful mediation isn't always measured by an agreement between the parties. As Lisa pointed out earlier, a lot of times the first point of success for a mediator, when they know they're moving in the right direction, is when they can get the parties to begin to communicate in a manner that is not adversarial, when they can begin to work together on trying to reach a resolution. Even if the parties aren't able to reach that plateau of an agreement, when they are able to work together on a continuous basis, that is also a measure of success. But we do seek a written agreement, because then that is a document that the parties can use to say or to represent or memorialize what they expect to happen, and also is a document that they can use to refer back to in the event that there are questions in the future. So, again, as Lisa said, you know, mediation is a voluntary process. It's a process that, you know, if it's unsuccessful, the parties have an opportunity to have their complaint returned. But most importantly, we like to remind the parties that mediation is something that they control. And that is the fundamental principle of mediation, is that the parties are in charge. They determine what is an agreement. They determine the parts of the agreement. And they have someone there who is an expert to facilitate that, to help them overcome impasses, which we'll talk about a little ways down, to help them make sure that everything they need to have in an agreement is there, but that they own the agreement. And that is the most empowering part of mediation. So at this time, what I would like to do is kind of talk about the mediation process. And basically what I'm doing here is just giving you the real nuts and bolts of what actually happens at the mediation table. The first part is getting the parties to the table. As Lewis talked about, and Lisa also talked about this a little bit as well. There are several different places where the parties, we communicate with the parties about mediation. Once we receive the complaint from the Department of Justice, we begin to talk to them about what mediation is. And that is an actual stage in mediation. It helps them set up what expectations are. We get them in the mindset of developing for themselves what they hope the outcome of mediation will be. And we want the parties thinking about this even before they begin the conversation with the other party. So we talk to them in advance. Then we bring the parties to the table, and we begin to set the stage for mediation in the mediator's, what's called the mediator's opening statement. And in this opening statement, not only will we talk about what will be covered in mediation, the parts of mediation, the introduction, identifying issues, process of the issues, brainstorming and resolution, but the mediator begins to set the tone for the dialogue. Hopefully the mediator is speaking in a way that is, you know, allows the parties to feel comfortable and to that he or she demonstrates a commitment to the process. And the mediator is trained to use intentional body language that demonstrates being open. The next step would be the identification of the issues present. In the ADA program, we start with the complaint. But beyond the complaint, we give all parties a chance to be heard, which is oftentimes the first time that has happened. For many, it's the first time the respondent has an opportunity to say, I didn't know. For the complainant, it's the first time for them to really explain why providing accommodations is important, not only from a legal perspective, but from a personal perspective. It allows the parties to educate the mediator about what happened, how the parties feel about what happened, what the parties think they want to happen so that the other side can hear it, and also how the parties are initially relating to each other in body language. The next step is processing the issues. And what we mean by that is taking it from a place of you're wrong and I'm right to what can we do to resolve this. So we go from, you know, it may be a start from substantial legal content or legal issues around the ADA. We allow parties to vent about emotional issues. And we also begin to highlight and itemize those things that the parties have in common, the responding wanting to be open to all of their patrons, the complainant wanting to patronize a certain business. And we build on those things continuously through the process. The next step would be brainstorming. And basically what we do is we begin to separate out all of the issues. Using the example that Lisa talked about, where you have a person who wanted to take her son to a sub shop that did not have an accessible entrance. So in that small segment, there are two issues there. The issue of not being able to participate or take her son to the sub shop and the fact that the sub shop doesn't have an accessible entrance. Those are two, in mediation, those are two separate issues that you want to address. The first issue of the fact that because of this inaccessible entrance, the mother couldn't take her son to the sub shop may be resolved with an apology. It may be other items that are wanted in order to resolve that. The second issue is the entrance itself, which the Americans with Disability Act completely spells out as far as what would make that, remove that barrier. So we separate the issues in mediation, and we begin to deal with the issues separate and apart from one another so the parties can focus on those specific issues. And when we begin to resolve those issues, we do it by brainstorming. A mediator in that instance would list all of the ideas that the parties have for resolution. And it's important to note that when brainstorming, the mediator doesn't qualify those issues. Every issue goes up. Every opportunity for a solution is presented. And only after all the parties have participated and provided possible solutions for the issues that have been presented, do they begin to qualify those issues and discuss them one at a time. The only thing that we definitely preface for our mediators, though, is when there is an issue of money, that issue is always talked about last. Beyond that, it's usually the training of the mediator, the experience of the mediator, that gut feeling of the mediator where they begin to try to attack those issues which they believe can be resolved more easily than others that they address first. Then finally, the mediator would commemorate the terms of an agreement in writing if the parties choose to do so. Again, as emphasized before, an agreement is not always the end-all be-all of what determines a successful resolution. And additionally, for the program, success doesn't end at simply coming to an agreement. Success is also determined by the implementation and the satisfaction of the implementation by the complainant. But what the mediator does when the mediator's role when reducing the agreement to writing is to include the mechanisms for resolving the agreement. When will something happen? How will it happen? Who will verify that it has happened? Will there be follow-ups? How will the parties address any future disputes? Will the parties agree to resume mediation in the event of certain things happening? Or if there's a dispute, the parties will generally, in this program especially, agree to mediate again. And always included in the agreement is a mechanism for future contact and communication. So that is there a contact person for the respondent or store or a hotel that the complainant should call in the event that they have a concern or a question. All of these things not only work to resolve in the specific agreement, but also work towards allowing for the parties to continue their communication and be able to resolve complaints on their own after the mediation is concluded. And finally, what I want to kind of talk about is we've talked about mediation and we've talked about our process, and I think it's important just to kind of mention that there are many different styles of mediation. If anyone has ever been involved in other types of mediation, you may have participated in the evaluative mediation form in which mediators may express a view or an opinion or what they think is a fair and reasonable settlement for the parties to agree to. That is not something that we do in our program. Our program, we allow the parties to wholly determine what is the outcome. Also, another type of mediation style is transformative mediation. In which a mediator does not seek a resolution of the immediate problem, but rather seeks mutual recognition of the parties involved. Additionally, the parties define their own issues and how they wish to seek solutions. Again, that is not how we operate in this program. The way we operate in this program is what's called a facilitative mediation, in which our role is to dedicate ourselves to identifying the specific issue which has been laid out in the complaint and ensuring that the parties work on that issue through resolution and through implementation. So I hope I've covered enough of what mediation is and how our process works and the various styles of mediation, that as Lewis begins to talk about the specifics of our mediation program, you'll have a foundation of understanding. So with that, I'll turn over this to Lewis so he can begin to talk about the mediation program.
Thanks, Dunzel. And basically what we'd like to make sure that this audience has today at the end of our presentation is that basic understanding of what mediation is for those who might be less familiar with it, as well as expectations for what this particular mediation program is like for people who participate in it. Because oftentimes, BIBTACs serve as resources for both respondents and complainants who are participating in our process or might participate in our process. So we want to make sure that the listeners on the call today understand what to expect with respect to their complaint moving through this program. So when we receive a complaint from the Department of Justice, the first thing we do within the first week of receiving the case is we contact the complainant and we contact the respondent. We contact complainants first. They often will be more familiar with the process because they've already signed a release to participate in mediation. They already are more likely to be more familiar with the ADA. We contact the complainant first, and we provide some degree of technical assistance on what mediation is, what the ADA mediation program is, and when necessary, we refer people to publications from the Department of Justice on the Americans with Disabilities Act, or refer complainants to advocates and try and connect complainants to resources that will help them participate effectively in the mediation. We also manage expectations, as Donzel said, about what the mediator will be doing and what the mediator won't be doing. So we will often stress that the mediator is impartial, that the mediator is not an investigator and not a judge and cannot impose a decision. So with both complainants and respondents, we at every opportunity look to make sure that they're informed about what the mediation process will be and what it won't be. So we then contact respondents. We contact them second because as the complaint is passed to us from the Department of Justice, the department is also sending correspondence to the respondent indicating that the complaint is going ahead in mediation. We like to make sure that the respondents have received that correspondence, and then we contact them to follow up, provide them a copy of the complaint as it was filed with the Department of Justice in accordance with the release form that resulted in the case being forwarded to mediation. And we will, again, stress what the mediator will and won't be doing, what the timelines are for the program, when we receive a complaint, the complainant has already agreed to participate in mediation, but the respondent hasn't. So in working with respondents, we're working with them to provide a technical assistance on mediation, the ADA mediation program, and the Americans with Disabilities Act, again, by pointing people in the direction of Department of Justice materials, the standards, certainly informing them that they can, if they're not already represented by counsel, that certainly the respondents and complainants can be represented by counsel. And we generally just make sure that the parties are informed, and we also start doing the work of mediation prior to the case going to our mediators that will be providing the service usually face-to-face locally around the country, also by teleconference when necessary. We look to have parties already hopefully shifting out of an adversarial approach to resolving this dispute to making the most of the mediation opportunity so that we can maximize that efficiency, maximize that creativity that comes from parties addressing these issues themselves with the assistance of professional third-party neutrals. So we're already working with parties to move them in that direction prior to the case being assigned to an actual mediator. Again, we'll be orienting parties towards timelines that basically respondents should have a decision whether or not to participate in mediation within a week. We can be flexible on that to a certain extent if there are extenuating circumstances where counsel may need to review a situation or in larger institutions, both state and local governments and larger corporations where there might be levels of review that are required. We have some flexibility, but the emphasis is always moving to a decision about participating in mediation or not as quickly as possible. When respondents refuse mediation, we return the case to the department for their review and inform the complainant of that. When respondents agree to participate in mediation, we refer the matter to a mediator that we've assigned who we think is the best match for that case, both in terms of where they're located, in terms of their subject matter knowledge of the type of case it is, whether it's effective communication, barrier removal, program access. We'll have a mediator lined up. We assign the case. And again, just like with respondents and complainants, will provide some technical assistance on the specific type of complaint, refer the mediators to resources so they can be maximally informed about the area of law they're working in. Of course, they've all been trained by us originally, and we do work with them to provide technical assistance on an ongoing basis, but when we're looking at a particular complaint, we'll review the complaint carefully with a mediator before the mediator contacts the parties. Mediators need to contact parties within 2 business days of us referring the case to them. Again, we're always trying to move these as quickly as possible. We also, as the mediation firm and the mediator, we're the public accommodations here. So we have to ensure that the location is accessible, that there are alternative formats, that there's effective communication, including the provision of interpreters. Also, there may be access issues with respondents. Sometimes we'll need language interpreters. There have been a number of cases recently where Mandarin interpreters have been required. So we look to provide access for parties, both with respect to the ADA and more broadly. Then we make sure when the respondent when the mediator has called the respondent and complainant and scheduled a date for mediation, we get that to the department so that the department knows that the cases are moving. We also then, before the mediation proceeds, the parties have to sign an agreement to mediate form. This is very simple and straightforward. Important elements are that the agreement that the process is confidential, that the parties will work in good faith together, that any party has a right to legal review, that there'll be respectful for communication. And this agreement to mediate form is used in almost every mediation context and is a useful tool for mediators to refer parties back to basically, let's say one party might say, well, maybe if this doesn't work out, we'll take this to the media. Well, it's helpful for the mediator to be able to refer to the confidentiality agreement and say, well, you know, everything that's discussed in mediation is confidential, and to remind parties of that obligation. Also, to make sure that everyone has an opportunity to fully express their perspective, parties can refer to the rules to mediation as well to say, well, you know, I understood that I would be treated respectfully here. So if there, it's a great tool for all the participants in the mediation process to refer to. And that has to be signed before the mediation proceeds. Lisa also mentioned some cases will proceed by teleconference. Again, transient lodging is a classic case. There are often other reasons as well. Sometimes it's a way to ensure access to the process if traveling might be difficult for someone. A key element of our program is, and a key quality assurance piece is we always review all agreements that are reached in all cases. That would be Donzel and myself review every agreement. And that basically, we ensure that every issue that was listed in the presenting complaint is addressed in the mediation agreement, that there's nothing contrary to law that's been agreed to, that there is specificity and timelines for what is going to be done when. And again, a key aspect of our program is the mediation process continues beyond the actual mediation meeting and continues until all parties agree that all terms of the agreement have been implemented and that the complainant is satisfied. So we also want to make sure that that process moves as smoothly as possible. Sometimes it may be that there's very little that will be done in the future, but sometimes there'll be agreements, let's say, an amusement park that has hundreds of acceptable elements that have to be addressed over maybe more than a year. So there, we want to make sure that the parties agree how they're going to monitor and confirm implementation. So are there going to be site visits? Are there going to be photographs sent back and forth? Will outside people participate in that? Will there be mystery shoppers to ensure that service animals are and people who use service animals are admitted into public accommodations? We also make sure that there are things that, let's say if an agreement comes to us and all there is compensatory relief and there's nothing about access, that really doesn't happen, but we always want to make sure that the issue of law is addressed. So we want to make sure that if the issue was access for people who use service animals, that there's not just an agreement to provide $500 to the complainant and there's nothing about modifications to policies and procedures, training, signage, those typical pieces of injunctive relief we would generally see in those cases. We also want to make sure that any release language is appropriate, doesn't waive future civil rights. We want to make sure that there are contingencies there so that if a permit can't be got, or what alternatives to barrier removal might be in place during a construction project, things of that nature. All along, in addition to working with the complainants and respondents and mediators, we're managing the process in general. So we're making sure that the parties and the mediators are adhering to deadlines, that they're adapting to situations as they come up. We're tracking cases through implementation, checking in with parties. Sometimes we lose touch with parties. Sometimes complainants or respondents may have illnesses or deaths to contend with, and we will always make every effort to contact complainants and respondents and keep them engaged in the process. If after many attempts, including certified letters go out with requests for response, and if we don't get any, will eventually need to return complaints to the Department of Justice. But again, 79% of the time over the period of the contract, parties will reach an agreement that addresses the presenting allegation in a manner that's compliant with the ADA, not contrary to law in any way, and the parties express their satisfaction and the complaints are closed. With that, I'd like to pass it back to Donzel to cover some additional material.
All right, so real quickly, I just want to kind of, as Lisa indicated earlier, our success rate is 79%, and the reason that we're at a 79% success rate, which is pretty high or is at the better level than most mediation programs, is because of the collaborative effort of the Keybridge Foundation along with its mediators to get parties beyond any of their the disagreement that they have, and working collectively to address impasses or issues that may hinder the parties coming to an agreement. And a lot of times that happens through reframing and addressing issues in a systematic, consistent manner in which the mediators have been trained to do. Everything from moving the parties from position to interest, an example would be from a person saying, a doctor refuses to see me because I'm deaf, to identifying the issue as that person's understanding of the right to have effective communication. A doctor's position of, I don't want to have to pay for an interpreter, to the understanding that interpreters should be seen as an overhead cost, a concern of a doctor of canceled appointments, and helping them understand that they would handle a canceled appointment of a person who's deaf the way they would handle a canceled appointment of any individual who's a patient. Also, the issue oftentimes impasses that allow that we overcome deal with money. A person understanding or believing that they are deserved or that they deserve to be compensated. One of the things we as mediators understand is that a person can bring any issue to the table that they desire. And as I spoke before, when it comes to solutions, we do not qualify any solution prior to it being brought to the table. One of the things we may do, a technique that we may use, however, is to have the person explain to us why they believe they deserve compensation. Begin to talk about how they came to the amount that they've come to with regards to compensation. And we transition the parties from, you know, what they do not agree with to what they do agree with. So, again, we've talked about several things, and we've talked about the mediation process. We've talked about styles, the procedure in the ADA mediation program. But one of the things that is as important as the process is ensuring that the parties have access to the process. And KeyBridge, over the last several years, have gone through great lengths to ensure that that access is there. So, Louis, in light of the time, I want to just go ahead and, Herb, allow you to get to that access to the process and talk about that a little.
Sure, and basically there are accesses on several different levels. There's the one immediate ADA access and providing effective communication, alternative formats, accessible mediation locations. That's, of course, essential. There's also the quality assurance piece that adds a protection for access to the process for all parties. Again, reviewing agreements, tracking implementation, those elements kind of are a part of ensuring access to the process. Over time, we've come up against specific ways in which to add to quality assurance. Mediation developed out of a number of different fields before coalescing into a field of its own. Mediators came out of legal backgrounds and medical backgrounds. In those professions, there are appropriate ethical ways under limited circumstances to determine the capacity of people. We noticed at one point that there was a temptation among mediators to determine the capacity of parties. We at KeyBridge Foundation wrote an extensive article and did a number of trainings around the issue of making sure that mediators don't do capacity determinations, but rather facilitate the mediation competencies of all parties, regardless of whether they have disabilities or do not. So a positional attorney may be much more difficult to work with in a given mediation than someone who might be struggling with cognitive disabilities. So we have worked over the years to ensure that the mediators know how to promote everyone, regardless of disability, in exercising their self-determination, which includes participating in a voluntary way, as well as ensuring that parties work well together to allow for that creativity, to allow for that efficiency. So we always work to provide access in on a variety of levels in the ADA mediation program. Again, these are real-life impacts. I think of a woman with very serious disabilities who was working with a group that provides meals to people in their homes, and she had very specific dietary requirements that were not being met. So literally before her case came to mediation, she really wasn't able to eat and to basically be nourished. And through mediation, she was able to reach an agreement with the provider to ensure that she was able to receive food that she could eat. And not only was that one problem resolved, but, you know, she developed a way to stay in contact with the management as it changed over time. And so, these are really real-world situations. And in mediation, it's very creative so that people can voluntarily, the respondent and the complainant, if they agree, they do not have to limit themselves to the issue in the presenting complaint. For example, I had a theater case where there was an allegation about lack of assistive listening equipment. The theater was really inspired by the mediation process and agreed to provide assistive listening equipment to over 100 theaters. They don't have to be limited to the presenting complaint because it's their process. If they, on a voluntary basis, go beyond that, they're welcome to. Also, we have cases where parties agree to waive confidentiality together and do joint publicity because maybe they approached the process in an adversarial way, but their mutual understanding was built over time. And through the mediation process, they agree to, highlight how the business has taken steps to become accessible and compliant with the ADA. So there are a lot of creative outcomes that come out of these cases that we'd be happy to speak more about if there's time during questions. And just a couple of quotes from parties that we've had over the life of the program. We've had respondents say things like, this was a good, solid mediation. The mediator expressed patience and understanding with elderly persons on the other side. The mediator was excellent, fair, sensitive, balanced, very positive. A number of other quotes, like very impressed with both the process and the mediator. The mediator was very professional, carried a bit of the human element. We were all treated equally. These are all respondents speaking. Some quotes from complainants, fabulous process, would do it again. Another, the owners had a good attitude and were very compassionate, gracious to our point of view. They were prepared with a plan to resolve the problem and agreed to our other requests. And one thing we'd like to say certainly is that we're always available to speak more about the program with any folks who are participating today.
And in closing, I would just like to kind of summarize by saying there are many different there's a lot of statistical data about the program, from when we first started in the first 5 years of the program. I think we were assigned roughly 1,200 cases. In the last 4.5 years, that amount has gone up to 800 cases, and as Lisa indicated, with 4,000 cases total. There are many things that can be said about the program, but the one thing that we want to make sure that everyone comes away with is that mediation resolve disputes quickly and satisfactorily, and generally can be done in a way that is less expensive and less time-consuming than other formal ways of resolving disputes, including investigation and litigation. And beyond those numbers of, 1,200 cases in the first 5 years and 1,800 cases in the last 5 years, what we like to look at is that those are 1,200 individuals and 1,800 individuals whose lives have been impacted positively because of mediation, allowing them to be the expert on disabilities and bring a solution to the table that the respondent, a person that they had a conflict with, agreed to.
So I'd say with that, we're ready for questions.
And ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to queue up to ask a question, please press star, then one on your touchtone keypad. Again, if you would like to queue up to ask a question, please press star and then one.
While we're waiting for people to queue in, can you give us an idea of what have been the most frequent issues, if there is such a thing, that you've had with the program as far as types of issues the most frequently, if there is such a thing, I guess?
Sure. Lisa, I'll tackle that first, and then Lewis and Donzel, who have the stats at their hands, will probably chime in. The vast majority of complaints that we receive have to do with barrier removal, and you could see how those type of complaints lend themselves to mediation, in part because of the terminology used. You know, we have to look at what's readily achievable, and there are important distinctions. There are so many varieties of ways to ensure readily achievable barrier removal that I would say that's the most common kind of complaint, and so the discussions do take the flavor of what is easy to accomplish me and what's without much difficulty or, you know, financial issues, and barrier removal would be the number one type of complaint. And Donzel, I think you were able to...
Yeah, I have a little bit.
Those stats?
Yeah. So, again, of the 4,000 or so cases that we've received so far, about 27% of those are Title II, and the remaining 73% are Title III cases, which are public, private entities. Again, and I was kind of looking at this, in the last 5 years, like I said, we've received about 1,800 cases. 44% of those, about 799 cases, are barrier removal cases. 30% deal with about 528 cases, deal with policy, which is everything from providing a sign language interpreter to allowing a service animal in a facility. So policy would be allow service animal, everything from guest accompanying individuals. And then the last, about 15% would be auxiliary aids providing effective communication, which would cover interpreters. And that's about 284 cases.
Thank you. And can you also, while we're waiting for some folks to queue up and think about their questions, when you talk about people that are entities that have, you know, refused or don't want to when they're approached or given the option for mediation, do you get a sense of, or can you give any kind of a synopsis of what the reasons entities might give for not wanting to participate in the mediation process?
Sure. I'll start and then turn it over to Lewis and Donzel. Well, certainly we have a number of complainants who initially, out of fear, are hesitant to participate. So that's one issue. And actually, it doesn't have to be in this forum, but later on, I'd love feedback on what else we can do to ensure that our program and the process are accessible. So what impediments do advocates or people with disabilities see in participating in the program? I'm happy to talk offline at any point about this and benefit from everyone here's expertise and experiences. But respondents, when they refuse mediation, sometimes they'll say, I didn't do anything wrong. Why should I sit down with this person? It was all a misunderstanding. And what frequently the entities will do, particularly with public accommodations, is they'll try to move towards what we would see as a more investigative stage. And we at the Department of Justice are in this informal process. We are opening the possibility of a dialogue, and so it really is up to the parties whether they participate or not. And you know, we've certainly talked about some of the positive outcomes for all parties, and we at the Department of Justice initially explained to the entities the benefits and how DOJ not investigating simultaneously or if there's a positive outcome. I mean, we certainly talk about that a lot. And then we really do offer it and let them decide. But KeyBridge does a particularly good job in talking with the respondents. So let me turn it over to Lewis or Dunzel to explain firsthand what they then do.
I'd be happy to jump in on that. Basically, we hear a lot of things from respondents, and we do spend a lot of time using mediator techniques like reality testing and reframing to help respondents really consider giving the mediation opportunity a chance. And when that is reaches an end point and respondents do not choose to participate in mediation, we hear a number of different things. One, it might be that just like with complainants participating in the process, that respondents, as Lisa indicated, can be fearful about the process. Specifically, they may be fearful about the good faith of the complainant. They might fear that the complainant is more interested in money than in compliance. Sometimes respondents are wanting a determination from the Department of Justice. They want the clarity of an investigation, of an entity telling them, this is exactly what you must do. Sometimes there's fear about the creativity of the ADA of the mediation process, because what they want is just someone tell me what to do. I don't want to reach an agreement with this individual if that's not going to pass muster in a court case or in a department investigation. So sometimes there's a fear about the good faith of the other party. Usually we can break those resistances down through carefully explaining about the legal review that's available, the available of getting additional expertise to the table in the form of an outside expert to provide reliable information that both parties can use to craft an agreement. So there are a lot of ways around that. And sometimes respondents simply don't want to comply with the law. Sometimes they know what they need to do and they don't want to do it, and so they won't agree to participate in mediation, in which case all of this is happening in that enforcement context. Case goes back to the department, and the KeyBridge Foundation's role in it is over, but the case is not.
And if I could just add to that, I mean, I really want to emphasize that of the 4,000 or so cases that we've offered mediation to, only 14% or 573 respondents have refused mediation, and that's over the course of the full September of 1998. Into the 1999 fiscal year. So for the most part, parties agree to mediate. And then when we look at the reasons why respondents refuse mediation, it's generally, in some instances, where police have been involved, where a person has been asked to leave the property and have been escorted off the property by a police officer. Respondents, as Lewis indicated, feel that the person isn't operating or acting in good faith. Everything from transfer and ownership, and you know, based on where the distant owners of franchisor or franchisee has changed, but the employees are still there and the issue is still there, so you know, we may not see that as inappropriate for mediation, and because the issues are still there, we count that statistically as a case in which a respondent has refused. And then there's also issues of where they just, it may be a barrier, language barriers, cultural barriers, are sometimes issues, and an inability simply to reach the respondent. A lot of times, the decision maker is just not present. You have a store, like a convenience store, that's owned by someone who does not live in the state or is not local, and the person just refuses to give us that contact information, and we will not put a non-decision maker at the table.
And I'll just finish up, this is Lisa again, and say, truly, the low refusal rate is due in part because we've contacted the respondents giving information here at DOJ, but in large part due to these efforts that KeyBridge is explaining, these efforts that KeyBridge is explaining to you. If we checked how many respondents might initially refuse mediation, the stats would be very different. So this education process for all parties is really crucial.
Okay, great. Thank you. And do we have any questions that have queued up in the meantime while we've had this discussion, please?
Yes. Our first question comes from Anita Thompson. Your line is open.
Thank you. Great presentation and great data. I'm glad to hear that. I was sure it was out there somewhere. I would like to know, is there a deadline or time frame under which a person can start this process?
So under Title III, there's no deadline. So if a complaint, if a person with a disability or an advocate wants to file a complaint with regard to a public accommodation or Title III complaint, there's no time limit. If there are allegations about a Title II entity, a state or local government, a person would have to file that complaint within 180 days. And I want to make sure I understood the question. Is that what you were asking about, timelines for filing complaints?
Yes, that is the question on the table for that.
Great.
And also, okay.
Sure.
Have you completed? Okay, and another quick question. Would you please provide contact information, phone number, email, that type of thing for us, please?
Sure. It should
I just, Lisa, let me clarify. That was in the materials that everybody had. You should have had a copy of, in all the materials, the contact information for Lisa as well as for
Lewis
and Donzel. So just so people know that. You did have that in written information as part of the handouts today.
And also, there's excellent information. We always, in providing our technical assistance, refer folks to the ADA.gov, www.ada.gov. There are links on the right-hand side of the homepage there that say how to file a Title III complaint and how to file a Title II complaint. That's all there. And basically, the one ingredient that I think Lisa said was, if people request mediation in the text of the complaint, that is considered.
And also, I just wanted to point out that our presenter today provided us some links that were also in your handout materials specific to KeyBridge, the mediation program at ada.gov as well. So those, all those things are actually in your materials that you should have been able to receive when you signed in to access all your materials for today's session, just to, so you have them. I know it's always hard when somebody gives something verbally. Everyone scrambles to write it down, but you do have it in written format.
In addition to the ADA information line, the DIPTACs are a wealth of information, but here at the Department of Justice, our information line is as well, and the 800 number and the DDD number are on there as well.
Yep, great, thank you. And next question, please.
Our next question comes from Rick Edwards. Your line is open.
I was asking about the voluntary portion of this. Who covers the costs that are incurred in the process, like, for example, any kind of travel or the outside experts you were talking about or even interpreters for the process?
Great question. The Department of Justice pays for the mediator, and if there are any costs in locating the neutral place, neutral and accessible place, which the mediation occurs. The sign language interpreters or foreign language interpreters are also paid for by the Department of Justice, and if the mediator had to travel, we also pay for that. And, gentlemen, what am I missing?
I think basically that's it. The Department of Justice, it's their program. They cover the cost of everything. And I've got one quote from a respondent here that said, this is tax money well spent. So I think that's the bottom line. This is tax money.
One of the things that Ricky Edwards mentioned, though, was in the event of an outside expert. That's something that the parties generally agree on. And if there's a cost for that, then the parties agree on how that cost will be handled with regards to verifying, if you're talking about, you know, with regards to expert on compliance or verifying implementation.
Great point. And I don't know how often that happens, because if the outside expert is from an independent living center or another advocate, maybe those costs don't add up. But great question and good point. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question in queue comes from Debbie Jackson. Your line is open.
Hello. You didn't mention if once in the mediation process, once it's underway, if the parties for some reason don't interact well with the mediator, do they have the option to ask to be reassigned another mediator?
Great question, and the answer is absolutely unequivocally yes. And KeyBridge handles this, no questions asked. Go ahead, Lewis or Denzel.
That's exactly right. Basically, if there's a request from either party for a change in mediator, we will honor that once without any question whatsoever. We also have to be careful to make sure that there's some continuity and to the process and that it continues to move forward. But our policy is, you know, certainly with one request from either party for a change of mediator, we will just do that, no questions asked, immediately, and move on. And, you know, It rarely comes up, but that's part of our quality assurance.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next question, please.
Nisha, one more question in queue. Michelle Cobbs, your line is open.
Just real quickly. Have there been instances where cases are not over, even though both parties agree? And because their agreements are lower than the bar that the law requires, or there are additional risks to others, and I understand there are confidentiality issues, if these cases have occurred, what are the next steps that would be taken?
Can I grab that one?
Sure.
This is Lewis. It does come up. It's rare. Where basically, you know, we're contractually obligated to ensure that our agreements are not contrary to law. And there are cases where complainants are willing to accept things that are contrary to law. And it is really rare, but we do have a contractual and ethical obligation to recuse ourselves from cases that where, you know, the parties are interested in agreeing to something that, you know, shouldn't be agreed to. And in such cases, we will return those to the department for their review.
And this is Don. So examples of where that may happen is where what we describe as parties not addressing the ADA issue, but specifically addressing a compensation issue, where a respondent may agree to pay a complainant monetary damages but not address the issue that was raised in the ADA complaint. We would never allow that to happen as an agreement or a successful resolution. Or if providing a hypothetical that's kind of will give you a vignette into something that has actually happened, if a hotel says, you know, we would allow a service animal or service dog into the hotel provided someone shows documentation, and the complainant may be fine with that because they have some form of documentation, but because the law does not require documentation, we would never say that that was a successfully resolved complaint.
Great, thank you. Well, we've kind of concluded. We've come to the end of our hour and a half time period, and I think that there was a lot of discussion generated and some good comments and thoughts, and hopefully everyone enjoyed the presentation today. I do want to thank our speakers, Lisa, Denzel, and Lewis, for taking time out of your very busy schedules to present this information and be able to share this with our participants on a national level, as this is a very viable and very important program that I think, as all of you have indicated, doesn't get as much play or as not as well known as probably it could be and could be very useful to people who don't know or aren't as aware of it or have been afraid to explore it. For those of you that are participating today, you will be sent an evaluation email that you can fill out. We do strongly encourage you to complete that and give us the feedback. We use that information as we are now in the process of developing our agenda for the next 12 months, starting October 1st. I do invite you to our session next month, which is going to be focusing on the hospitality industry and tools for helping to educate the hospitality industry and what's out there related to their compliance issues as we now are moving forward to new regulations for lodging and things happening in 2012. And what just the updates that we've had in the regulations for Title III in the last several years. So we do really encourage you to join us for that particular session. More information on that session is available at the www.ada-audio.org, or you can call our office at 877-232-1990, both voice and TTY, if you have any questions. Thank you again, everybody. Thank you, Denzel, Lewis, and Lisa, and everyone have a great rest of your day. Thank you, and you can disconnect at this time.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining today's conference. This does conclude the program, and you may now disconnect.